statement of the area CFT correspondence, which I stated rather generally by asserting that this is an equivalence between a class of conformal field theories in D dimensions and string slash quantum gravity. In an asymptotically ADS1, ADS D plus 1 space-time, perhaps time some internal space. We won't worry about this internal space. I'll tell you a few things about it as we go along today. But roughly speaking, we have a D-dimensional field theory, and everything we want to know about this can be understood by studying some gravitational theory in this higher dimensional space-time. And the CFT we decided to characterize by two parameters. Our two parameters were an effective central charge and some coupling, a proxy for a coupling lambda. And there was a relation between these two sides for any value of C effective and lambda. But in the limit C effective being very large and lambda being very large, this side simplifies to what I will call Einstein-Hilbert gravity. Whose action is quite simple, it's just the action in D plus one dimensions of gravity as we know it in our real world, except with a negative cosmological constant, plus some dots I'm not writing down. The dots will encode the spectral information about the CFT, as we'll see in a second. And I wrote down this formula, which said that the generating function for correlation functions in the CFT which you can think of as a logarithm of the correlator evaluated with finite sources for operators is given by, I didn't write down this intermediate formula last time, but let me write this down. It's given by the partition function of the string with boundary conditions set by these sources. The sources, I remind you, if you're trying to compute correlation functions of quantum objects, the sources are classical, so I can use them to set boundary conditions for this gravitational problem. So I'll describe that in detail. And in the limit that we focus on, this tough limit, this becomes the on-shell action of gravity with these boundary conditions. Okay, so this partial equals JSS is my code word for setting boundary conditions in terms of this data. So to explain this statement, I need to remind you a little bit about what the anti-de Sitter geometry looks like. And I believe you had some introduction to this in the gravity lectures last week, but let me just go over it for completeness. So ADS D plus 1, you can think of in many ways. But there's one way that you can think of it which is very useful and illustrates all its symmetries in one go. So I'll define it as a hyperboloid in a D plus two dimensional space with two time directions. Okay, it's D plus two dimensional with D space directions and two time directions, and the hyperboloid is defined by this equation, x minus 1 squared minus x 0 squared plus it's a locus of points in this d plus 2 dimensions which satisfy this hyperbolic equation. Okay? So just the way you define a sphere in flat space as the locus of points which are unit distance from the origin, this is unit distance, but unit distance with this funny inner product. So the metric on RD, 2 is simply the flat metric with the signature and if you solve this equation to find coordinates on the surface and plug them into this equation, you will get the metric on the ADL space. So I'll draw one picture. You'll see a variant of this picture later. Okay? So this is what the hyperboloid looks like. It's a hyperboloid, but embedded in this funny signature geometry. And the surface of this hyperboloid is the ADS space. But that's a picture of ADS as embedded in some higher dimensional space. But we could just forget about this embedding and write down coordinates on ADS space intrinsically and think about how ADS looks like in its own right. So intrinsic coordinates on ADS, I'll write down two sets of them, and your problem sheet from last week had questions of how to get from this embedding to the intrinsic coordinates. So the first coordinate I'll write down are global coordinates. And now, from now onwards, I'll just write down the metric in d plus 1 dimensions. And this metric is the following. I'll pick some coordinate r and some temporal direction t. And that's the global metric on ADS, where I have chosen to write d omega d minus 1 as the metric on a round d sphere embedded in flat RD. Okay. So d omega d minus 1 is, you can write this as d theta 1 squared plus sine squared theta 1 d omega d minus 2 squared, and this recursion tells you how to write the metric on a sphere of arbitrary dimensions. Okay. Now, this geometry preserves rotational symmetry. This coordinates preserves rotational symmetry on the sphere, okay? And it has an explicit time translational symmetry because the metric doesn't depend on the time coordinate. And those are the only two symmetries that are being preserved here. The symmetries this hyperboloid preserves is much larger. So the symmetries here are the Minkowski, the rotation group in d plus 2 dimensions, which leave this inner product invariant, and that's the special orthogonal group SOD, 2. Okay? The special orthogonal group SOD is just a rotation group in d dimensions, it's just a group of vectors that is you rotate them. If I just change the sign of two vectors, the inner product between two vectors, and make them negative, I get this non-compact group SOD, 2. This geometry preserves a subset, which is SOD, which is the rotation group of the sphere, times time translations, which I'll write as RT. Okay? These coordinates cover all of ADS, and I can sort of draw a picture for you of what ADS looks like in these coordinates. Let me draw that in color because I'll fill it in a bit. I have, to see what it looks like, let's look at what happens to this geometry as r, this coordinate r goes to infinity. As this coordinate r goes to infinity, you sort of ignore this, look at the metric induced at constant r, so you forget about this middle term. As r goes to infinity, I can forget about this 1 relative to this r squared. So what I have is a metric on time, which is scaling like R squared, the sort of proper time is scaling like R squared, but the proper angular size on the spheres is also scaling like R squared. So as I go far, it looks like I have a copy of time cross a sphere, but time has Lorentzian signature, so what I have is a copy of a Lorentzian cylinder. A sphere, but propagated up in Lorentzian time. Okay? So that's the boundary of ADS. And then I sort of fill in that boundary with this R coordinate. So you can think of this, so let me draw this as a, I can't draw a D sphere, a D minus one sphere, but I certainly can draw a circle. So let's imagine I fill out this picture as follows. So I have a sphere times a line that's being propagated up and simultaneously being filled in by this radial direction. In particular, while the sphere is infinitely big near the boundary where r goes to infinity, the sphere shrinks to zero size as r goes to zero, right? Because the proper size of the sphere is being set by our coordinate r. So I have spheres which are infinitely big, and they come in, and then they shrink to a point at the origin. The origin is regular because the sphere shrinks in like the origin of plane polar coordinates in d plus d dimensions. The spatial cross-section here so this is R increases this way. This is the locus R equals 0. And we have time running up straight. So time equals minus infinity is way down below. Time equals plus infinity is way up. The spatial cross-section here, you can convince yourself, is a copy of a lower dimensional Euclidean anti-de-Sitter space, because it's a cross-section obtained by setting time equals constant. And with a bit of work, you can convince yourself that this metric solves an equation like this in one lower dimension with one of these x's flipped sign. But let me not do that exercise for you now. Let me just say that if you were in d equals 2, that is ADS 3, which is an example I'll keep coming back to because it's very simple. One can draw it explicitly. The spatial cross-section is just the Poincaré disk. Okay? The metric dr squared over 1 plus r squared over l squared plus r squared d phi squared, a two-dimensional metric, is the metric on the Poincaré disk of size of curvature radius L. So notice that there was a scale. Yes, we used LADS last time. I've just sort of dropped the subscript to keep writing simple. This is the curvature scale of the space-time, and that curvature scale is visible on every spatial leaf of this geometry. Okay. Questions? Yeah. Yes, so this space, the chi space is compact. So you can imagine doing Kaluza-Klein reduction and writing down a theory on ADS with just all the modes on the chi space. Think of chi as sort of, think of it as a product of circles. So I can mode decompose and write massive fields on ADS, and that's the theory we would get. In fact, this is exactly what we get out of all our string theory examples. We don't just get anti-de-Sitter space in some number of dimensions. We get it along with some extra dimensions, which are always compact. OK, so that's one set of coordinates. And this, if I were able to illustrate this better, I would have drawn for you the Poincaré disk, but I'm not going to try. I'm going to write for you one more coordinates. So these are the coordinates where the boundary has a compact spatial section, it's a sphere, and time is non-compact. And this is useful for studying field theories. On this space R cross SD minus 1. This space has a name. It's a famous Einstein static universe. I won't use it very much, but it's the d-dimensional Einstein static universe. It's what Einstein initially thought was a good model of our universe's cosmology. So it's a universe where there's a spatial section, just stays put. Yeah? The symmetries that are manifest in this presentation, in my coordinates, are SOD times RT. The full symmetry group is this symmetry group. Yes, because you see the SOD is just this SOD. The RT is just a non-compact part of SO2. So this has a subgroup, which is SOD times SO2. It has many subgroups. It has one of these is this. Because you can rotate in this 2-plane, and you can rotate in this D-plane. The rotation in the D-plane is SOD. The rotation in this 2-plane is SO2. Okay. When I unwrap this, I unwrap this to R. Okay. That's why I get R. Otherwise, I would get a compact time direction. I'll write down one more set of coordinates that you probably have seen, which are called Poincaré coordinates. They have nothing to do with the Poincaré disk in higher dimensions. But they're useful for other purposes. And let me just write down the metric in the Poincaré coordinates. Okay? So this is another metric on ADS. I'll use the same T. If you get confused, remember that I can put a subscript here, but let me not do that. This metric preserves explicitly a Lorentz symmetry in D dimensions. Okay? Because now I have translational symmetry in the X, I have translational symmetry in this new coordinate T, and I have rotations and boosts in the T and X. So this is like this piece, if you forget about the Z, is like Minkowski space in D dimensions, which is why the explicit symmetry preserved are these. And it's useful for studying the d-dimensional CFT on Minkowski space. Now you might wonder, okay, so I want to put a CFT on this space, I want to put a CFT on this space. These two spacetimes are related by a conformal transformation. Okay? So in 1 plus 1 dimensions, it's clear a Lorentzian cylinder can be mapped to a Lorentzian plane. In higher dimensions, the same is true. This is what Tom Hartmann was alluding to when he was talking about radial quantization. If you do radial quantization, you work here and work radially outward in Euclidean space. Here is the sort of the conformal map that takes you from the radially quantized plane to a cylinder. But for now, let's just think of these as two sets of coordinates. Now, these coordinates don't cover all of that cylinder that I've drawn. They cover only a part of it. And they cover a part of it that you get by slicing the cylinder with two null planes. Okay? So take the cylinder and wrap a handkerchief around it, and the edges of the handkerchief are going around the edge of the cylinder, and the interior of that slice is what's being and then sliced through the edge of the handkerchief by a null plane, and that's what these coordinates cover. Okay? And in these coordinates, it's a bit harder to draw. This locus, this orange locus of null planes, is z equals infinity, and the boundary is at z equals 0. Z tends to infinity is what's called the Poincaré horizon. It looks like a black hole horizon, but it's not quite a black hole horizon, but it has similar characteristics in the GR solution. And z goes to 0 is the boundary. And if you unwrap my handkerchief, what you really get is Minkowski space. So that's why this is a parameterization of ADS in coordinates that respect this Minkowski symmetry. Okay, so now we have coordinates. We have various pieces of data. So now I can tell you how exactly to set up this problem of mapping the data of the CFT to data of the gravity side. Yes? Sorry? Z equals 0 was the boundary of ADS. So it just covers a piece of the boundary from here to here. And if I should be a bit more precise, this time coordinate only covers this extent of global time. Okay? So in natural unit, it's just 2 pi times L ADS. Z infinity is this whole null plane. Both, top and bottom. There's a plot of, in the notes I put up, there's a plot of these coordinates, and you can see explicitly what are constant Z slices, constant T slices, and constant X slices on the cylinder. It's easier to see this plot than for me to try to draw it. Yeah? Correct. So this T, I can choose it so that it runs from minus infinity here to plus infinity here. So let me write it this way. T Poincaré runs from, can be taken to be non-compact, but T Poincaré going to minus infinity is T global going to, let's say, minus pi times LADS, and T Poincaré going to plus infinity is T global going to pi times ADS radius. So it covers only a segment of global time of bits 2 pi in ADS units. So you're right. It doesn't cover all of time. It only covers a patch of time in global coordinates. But I then rescaled it so that as measured by an observer sitting in these Poincaré coordinates, his clock runs from minus infinity to plus infinity. Okay, so two things. You already saw in a GR lecture what geodesics in this space-time do. If I put a massive particle here, let me not try to draw it in that diagram, they sort of oscillate back and forth. They're confined. So ADS behaves like a harmonic potential, everything sort of oscillates back and forth. There was a problem in the problem sheet to convince you that this harmonic potential analogy is actually accurate. If you actually put a field in ADS and try to find its eigenvalues, just solve the wave equation. Subject to the boundary conditions that the field is regular everywhere and it falls off sufficiently fast to be normalizable at infinity, you'll find a discrete energy spectrum in global ADS. Okay? You'll find a discrete energy spectrum that is a generalization of the harmonic spectrum simply because you get degeneracies from the sphere. Okay? But otherwise, it's perfectly harmonic oscillator in this setup. In the Poincaré coordinates, you don't expect quantization of energy because the Poincaré coordinates are sort of like an open system. There's a horizon here, so and things can leak out of the horizon, so you expect a continuum spectrum in the Poincaré coordinates, which is what you should expect if you don't put your field theory on compact space, but allow yourself to put a field theory on non-compact space. Okay? So symmetries work out. I've sort of given you embeddings of symmetries in the two cases. Now let's try to flesh out what the formal statement about these gadgets mean from the point of view of this set of coordinates. So I told you that the field theory lives someplace, and it holographically is dual to gravity. But now I'm going to make a slight sleight of hand and try to give you an intuition that you can think of the field theory as living on this blue boundary of ADS. It's a sleight of hand, it's a convenience, and it's very easy for me to use that to tell you how to interpret these statements. Okay? So I want to compute, so let's say I have some scalar field, I have some operator O. I should have said this before I do that. So these operators were some abstract operators in the field theory, and they carry quantum numbers. They're gauge invariant if you're talking about gauge theories. So there could be things like trace of the field strength. There could be trace of, if I was talking about n equals 4 Supiang Mills, there could be trace of xi, xj, dot, dot, dot. Okay? So various things of this kind, they're just built out of fundamental fields in my quantum field theory. They carry representations under, they carry quantum numbers. Under SOD comma 2, which is the group of conformal symmetries that act in D dimensions. Okay? So we have a theory that has not just Poincaré symmetry, but also scale invariance, so it has a bigger symmetry group, and that symmetry group in D dimensions for a conformal field theory is SOD comma 2. So at some very basic level, if you didn't know anything, we could have just postulated that the only way a conformal field theory which has this global symmetry could have been dual to anything was for it to be dual to ADS spacetime, because ADS spacetime is the only thing that has SOD comma 2 symmetry. Okay, so at the kinematic level, there is no information content in this statement. The symmetries dictate what to pick. It describes the part of the cylinder inside this orange, inside. Yeah. Everything is inside because you see, yeah, the whole thing is filled in. So there is a famous analogy. The boundary is like a boundary of a soup can. ADS is like the soup plus the soup can. So if you can slice your soup can in with null slices, that's what you get in Poincaré coordinates. Okay, so there are these quantum numbers. And if you have some internal global symmetries, you may have some other charges. You may have some baryonic symmetries. You may have something else. So times some, let me say, R internal. These quantum numbers map to quantum numbers in gravity. The SOD comma 2 is the isometric group of ADS, is a group of symmetries that leave the ADS metric invariant. And this R internal is the part that I've been ignoring, is the isometric group of this space X. So in n equals 4 Supiang Mills, the symmetry group is, the full symmetry group, the bosonic symmetry group is SO4, 2 times SO6 which is the symmetry group of ADS5 times S5. So SO4, 2 because it's a four-dimensional conformal field theory, and SO6 because this theory comes, if you remember, we put deep brains, which were four-dimensional object, in 10 dimensions, but we left the transverse six-dimensional space untouched, so we can rotate in those six-dimensional space, which is what this SO6 is, and this is the isometries of because ADS5 has isometry group SO4, 2 by what I described. A phi sphere is a locus of unit vectors in six dimensions, and unit vectors can be rotated in six dimensions along SO6. So at this point, it's actually a simple exercise in representation theory to match stuff on the CFT side with stuff in the gravity side or string theory side. For every object you want to study in field theory, you figure out what its quantum numbers are and just ask what the corresponding object looks like in the gravity. So say I have an operator O, which is like trace F mu nu, F mu nu. So F mu nu is some field strength for a non-abelian gauge field, but I've contracted the Lorentz indices, so it's a scalar object. So this guy should correspond to some scalar object that sits on that side. So it maps to some scalar field. Because it's a scalar under the Lorentz part. But the part that I haven't told you is that there's more quantum numbers to the conformal group than just the Lorentz quantum numbers. It's not just the fact that it's a scalar. There's one extra quantum number coming from the fact that we are talking about conformal group, and that you can think of as the energy measured by the conformal field theory. And that energy is naturally measured on the sphere. It's the eigenvalue for conformal dilatations. If you put the theory on a sphere of size 1, and you scale it up and put it on a theory of size 2, you can ask, what is the quantum number that sort of achieves that scale under that scaling transformation? And that scaling transformation gives you the dilatation charge or the whose eigenvalue is the conformal dimension. For this particular operator, it's what you see, it's 4. And so there's a corresponding object in the bulk which picks out the conformal dimension. I have a scalar field. I want to sort of parameterize the space of scalar fields that propagate in ADS. Well, there's one parameter that I can think of, because I'm just talking about representation theory, is the mass of the scalar field. So the conformal dimension, which labels representations on the field theory side, should correspondingly match to some other object that tells me what scalars do in the bulk, and that's the mass of the scalar. And I won't go through this exercise, but there's a very simple formula for relating for scalar operators relating the conformal dimensions to the mass. This formula has subtle. Okay, let me write down the formula and tell you one interesting. A very simple relation that tells you that given a mass m for the scalar, there's a corresponding delta, which is, and the only pieces of data that enter are the mass measured in ADS units. Mass is dimensionful. So this takes care of the dimensions and the dimension of the ADS space. Okay. So for the trace F squared, delta is 4, and the corresponding scalar is massless in the bulk. But you can generalize, you can just take any scalar operator you want with some conformal dimension, and it's dual to some field of the corresponding mass. What set of fields are allowed here depends on what theory I pick. because the spectrum of the theory tells me what the quantum numbers allowed are, and once I know what the quantum numbers on this side are, I can model my bulk side by just picking fields with those precise quantum numbers. So what that will do for you is at least set up the quadratic part of the gravitational theory, in the sense that I'm only giving you spectral information, I'm only giving you representation theory, I'm only giving you quantum numbers, I'm not telling you how these fields are interacting. So if I tell you a list of operators in the field theory, I give you a list of quantum numbers, you can go away and write down a list of corresponding fields with those which are scalars, vectors, spinners, tensors, et cetera, which carry those very same quantum numbers but propagate in ADS spacetime, and you can write down their two derivative Lagrangian with no trouble. How their three derivative and how their interaction terms and higher derivative pieces operate is now going to be a function of figuring out how these operators talk to each other in the field theory. So that's a question of interactions, which I'll come to in a second. So if you had been to Alicia's talk on Friday, the focused lecture, she showed you how to compute two-point functions of scalar operators based on this data. Was that, yeah?
Such correspondence would get modified if you take the higher order Lagrangian, then
higher order what?
The higher order corrections for Lagrangian.
Oh, so, yes. So the question was, do these statements get corrected away from the large n limit? And yes, they will get corrected, but for now, I'm just going to focus on the large n limit, where I can do this correspondence more precisely. For the particular operator I wrote down, there is no renormalization, but in the particular theory I wrote down, but in general, there will be. Okay. It's just the usual renormalization group. You can write down, for your non-interacting theory, you can write down some engineering dimensions. But as you increase the quantum effects, you will get anomalous dimensions. And the anomalous dimensions will go down with powers of 1 over n. So what I can write down for you are the analogs of the engineering dimensions very easily in the large n limit.
So the dilatation operator commutes to the Hamiltonian, is that right? That
I'm coming to gravity in a second. It will commute to the Hamiltonian.
Within the CFT, the delta, the conformal dimension?
Yeah.
It
is related to the energy as measured in the global space, yes. It's not the energy measured by the Poincaré generator. It's the energy of the global time direction on Einstein static universe. OK, so you can do more. We can do vectors, which I'll just sketch. So if you do massless vectors, let me do vector fields. So again, this object has some Lorentz indices. It's a vector field. It maps to some corresponding vector field in ADS. And if this vector field is conserved, which means that this is associated with some global symmetry by Noether, with a global symmetry current, then the bulk vector field is massless, i.e. gauge field. OK? So bulk gauge invariance is boundary global symmetry. Oh, my indices, these are boundary indices, are Greek, and bulk indices are Latin. You may ask, I started out by motivating the discussion with gauge symmetries in the boundary. Where is the boundary gauge symmetry? This is invisible in the bulk. because the only objects we can talk about in the bulk are gauge invariant objects. So you can't unpack them to see what they were built out of. Okay. So there was some n equals 4 Supi Yang Mills with some gauge group SUN. That SUN gauge group is just invisible except for one parameter, which is n, which is setting the strength of the size of ADS scale in Planck scale, Planck units. Okay. So it's just that one parameter that tells us what rank of the gauge group we were considering that shows up in the gravitational side as a ratio of length scales. You cannot unpack this story to figure out what the gluons of the field theory look like in the bulk. Okay, so, and I should just emphasize one useful thing which I'll re-emphasize in a second. Again, in the gravitational context, this conservation equation for the flavor symmetry follows from gauge invariance in the bulk. Okay, so they go hand in hand. If I have massless fields, you all know that massless fields imply gauge invariance. Massless vector and higher spin fields imply gauge invariance, and they in turn imply current conservation directly. So I can say the same thing for gravity, which is the case of interest. Let me keep this is useful. So if I have a massless spin 2 field in the bulk, it gets related to it's a massless spin 2 field, so it comes with gauge invariance, and the gauge invariance is the gauge invariance of gravity, that is diffeomorphisms in anti-de Sitter spacetime. And this graviton gets related to the one spin 2 object that is conserved and exists in any conformal field theory, which is the energy momentum tensor. So it has the right quantum numbers to be the energy momentum tensor. And there's a nice way to sort of get this energy momentum tensor for any solution, because the energy momentum tensor measures the energy in the gravitational field. So if I have the vacuum, I should expect the energy momentum tensor is zero. The expectation value of the energy momentum tensor is zero. But if I put on some excitations, I'll expect that the energy momentum tensor picks on some expectation value. So let me explain how that works by modifying this metric just a bit. And what I'm going to imagine is doing the following. I want to compute energy in gravity. And unlike in quantum field theory, where you have a rigid background, and I can measure energy locally, the one non-trivial fact about gravity is that local things don't really make sense. Local energy is not a sensible thing to measure in gravity, because you can sort of do diffeomorphisms and sort of change the value of energy. So the only thing that makes sense in a gravitational theory is the asymptotic value of energy, the energy measured by someone sitting at the edge of space-time. So let's try to see, and that's what makes sense here too. The boundary of energy momentum tensor is some sensible object. It's an object that you can measure. It's an operator in the conformal field theory. I should be able to talk about it. And so it should be related naturally to the asymptotics of this geometry. And it indeed is, which I can say for you in the following sense. So imagine we have our ADS geometry, which I've drawn for now as the vacuum space, no matter, nothing. And now let's come in and put in some localized lump of energy into this space-time. Okay? So this is going to have some, it's going to produce gravity, it's going to produce some gravitational field. So it could be a star that's sitting smack in the middle of ADS, it's sitting there for all time. And it's going to produce some gravitational tails. And I want to measure those gravitational tails just as I would measure Newtonian falloffs and use that to define a notion of energy. So to do that, I actually don't need to do too much work. If I know the gravitational solution for this star, I just take this solution and expand it out near the boundary of ADS, because I'm only interested in the Newtonian analog of Newtonian falloffs in the space-time. So I sort of measure how the metric away deforms as I come to z equals 0. And in general, you can convince yourself that if the boundary metric is flat, you get a piece in this coordinates which looks like this. I cheat a bit. There's some fine print, but let's ignore the fine print for now. In general, you can convince yourself that what will happen is the boundary matrix stays Poincaré in a Taylor expansion around z equals 0 up to the order z to the d. And there's a coefficient of the z to the d term, which indeed is this energy momentum tensor. Okay? So if you just do Taylor expansion of this metric for a known solution, you can read off the energy momentum tensor. The fine print is the following set of statements. In general, if you turn on various kinds of matter, you can have pieces that go from, in this gauge, from 1 to, which have subleading powers of z before z to the d. You could have powers like z squared, z to the 4, z to the 6, and so on, all the way before z to the d. They are not the interesting part of the energy momentum tensor. You have to renormalize them. So there's a renormalization scheme you have to implement to pull out this piece. There's also subtlety whether you're in even or odd dimensions. In odd dimensions, this is in odd dimensional boundary directions, that is d being odd, this is fine. In even boundary dimensions, there's a logarithmic term because of anomalies, but you can deal with it. Okay? So I won't go through those details. Those details are in the notes. But the rough intuition I want to give you is that if you know the near boundary metric, you know the energy momentum tensor. There's another way to say the same answer, which is much more covariant. I have a space-time, which is the cylinder. And the cylinder is sort of is a rigid body. The edge of the cylinder is some rigid body. The space-time inside is gravitational. It satisfies gravitational dynamics, so it's a floppy object. You know, gravity moves things around. The space-time bends around. If I sort of embed the cylinder in this floppy space-time, I can ask, how much is this cylinder curved relative to the straight cylinder of ADS? So that measures that. So that's an object that you can sort of think about it in general. So if I have a surface in three dimensions, I can ask how it's bent around in three dimensions. And that is a notion of extrinsic curvature, because it asks how this surface, as embedded in some higher dimensional space-time, is curved. So there's a notion of extrinsic curvature. Of the boundary, in this case, it's the notion of extrinsic curvature for any co-dimension surface, but let me just say extrinsic curvature of the boundary of ADS. And you can sort of measure it by taking this boundary and looking at the unit normal that goes inward from this boundary. Okay, so this boundary is co-dimension 1. There's one vector that points perpendicular to it, inward. So Na dot Na is 1. It's space-like. And the extrinsic curvature is just the covariant derivative is a symmetrized covariant derivative of this normal. And you can, in terms of the extrinsic curvature, which is the bending of this boundary into the bulk, you can write down a nice closed form expression for the energy momentum tensor. So you have to project this onto the boundary, but never mind. So the energy momentum tensor is roughly where gamma is the metric on the surface, whereas GAB is the metric inside. Okay, so that was roughly all I was going to tell you about how to map the basic elements of the dictionary that relate what's happening in the field theory with what's happening in the bulk. Okay? Everything at this level is very much representation theory. And once you know this representation theory, you can sort of fill out everything. Yes? Okay, so at this point, I'm talking about less about the actual geometry itself and more about the dictionary between what the set of operators you have in field theory with what set of fields you have in the gravity side. I haven't solved the gravity equations. I'm coming to that in a second. We have to figure out what the gravity solutions are. But for now, it's just a very kinematic map which says, I have this list of quantum operators, and I also have a corresponding list of classical fields. And there's a one-to-one correspondence between those quantum operators and classical fields, which is completely determined by this quantum numbers. Okay. One final thing I'll just say in this picture, which is useful, is that the conformal field theory lives in D dimensions. And there's one extra direction parameterized by this normal direction, or this, which was R in global coordinates or Z in these Poincaré coordinates, which takes us away from this boundary of ADS inside. We may ask, what exactly is this coordinate from the point of view of conformal field theory? It's the coordinate that I need to give a geometric description of the anti-de Sitter spacetime, but is there a meaning for this coordinate in field theory? And the answer is, roughly speaking, yes, at least near boundary. And I'll just tell you what the answer is, because this is useful intuition for what goes on. So I'll call this the radial direction. Which is parameterized by Z or R. It's the scale direction in conformal field theory. It's the energy scale of the field theory. And you can sort of roughly see this from the Poincaré metric. If I scale coordinates, if I want to sort of scale coordinates by taking T Poincaré to T Poincaré times some scale lambda, or let me not call it lambda, capital lambda, and x vector to x times lambda, I'm homogeneously scaling up my boundary field theory. But the Poincaré metric is invariant if I simultaneously also scale z to lambda z. If you ignore my correction term, if I just look at the first three pieces without the T mu nu piece, the T mu nu piece picks up an inhomogeneous piece, which is corresponds to its conformal dimension. But this piece of the metric is invariant under those scalings. So if I think of zooming out from some microscopic scale to a bigger scale in the conformal field theory, that is like going from some value of z, say z equals epsilon, to z equals lambda epsilon. So it's zooming, it's going further into the bulk. Okay? So this statement has a name. It's called the scale radius duality. Which relates ultraviolet scales in the field theory with stuff that happens near the boundary. And the infrared scales with stuff that happens deep into the bulk. So if I keep this pink, so if you ask questions about things that happen deep in the infrared at low energies, you need to access stuff that happens deep inside the ADS spacetime. If you ask questions that happen at very high energies, you can just answer them by staying close to the boundary of ADS. So this is a sort of covariantization of the usual ideas of renormalization group at some very qualitative level, where you merge the energy scale with the spatio-temporal directions where the field theory lives into some bigger structure. So ADS implements geometrically that idea. So people have played around with trying to derive renormalization group equations from ADS CFT this way. I'll refer you to the rather vast literature of that subject. But that's roughly what I wanted to give you intuition about the data between these two sides for the moment. Questions?
So the theory is not flowing. Is it flowing?
There could be states, or I could make the theory flow by turning on relevant operators. But so I haven't talked about very general geometries and very general states yet, but if I do that, the flow will be encoded as what happens in the radial direction.
And it's not CFT anymore.
It's not a CFT anymore. It could be that I have a CFT in the UV, I have a CFT in the IR, and there's a flow between two different ADS spacetimes with some intermediate region which is not an ADS spacetime. Correct. Okay, so now I can answer the question that was asked a moment ago, which is, And the present one, which is how do I determine what is happening in the bulk, how do I reconstruct the geometry, et cetera, et cetera. So let me give you the sort of abstract statement of what you should do, and then try to flesh that out in a very simple example that will lead us into naturally talking about entanglement. Okay, so the data in CFT are classical sources. We used to generate this generating function of correlation functions. Okay, so partition is a partition function of theory with non-trivial deformations induced by these classical sources. And you can think of the problem as follows. So J is the boundary value of the classical bulk fields in ADS D plus 1. So if I have my scalar field, phi, it depends on Z, and it depends on the boundary coordinates x mu. This includes time, so this is t comma x. And if you solve the classical equation of motion, solve the Klein-Gordon equation, say, you will find that this guy behaves as follows. I'll write the answer in a very suggestive form. This is the asymptotic form of the solution as z goes to 0. The two pieces, I'm solving a Klein-Gordon equation. So it's a second order differential equation. So the two linearly independent solutions. I can always reparameterize those linearly independent solutions to write them in terms of two unknown functions. The two unknown functions are functions of the boundary coordinates. And I've just pulled out the dependence on the z coordinate, okay, which tells me how things behave as I go towards the boundary. I wrote it, it's an analog of that metric, but now for some scalar field. This piece, the z to the delta piece, is a normalizable mode, is a mode that falls off fast enough so that if you integrate the Klein-Gordon norm, you get finite answer. The z to the d minus delta piece is a non-normalizable mode. So if you think of doing a spherical wave decomposition in flat space, you have pieces that go like 1 over r to the l plus 1 and 1 over an r to the l for different harmonics. This is like the r to the l piece which diverges at infinity, and this is like 1 over r to the l plus 1 that stays finite as you go to r infinity. So this non-normalizable mode, and I have already presaged what I'm going to say by choosing my notation explicitly, this J is this classical source for the field, for the corresponding operator. Whereas the coefficient of the normalizable mode is the response of the field theory to turning on a classical source. Okay, so from the gravity part, both of these pieces are classical. We are just solving classical wave equations, right? The question is, what do we do? What should we fix? And what should we measure in this case? So the thing that's not normalizable is a thing that wants to come into the boundary and deform it, okay? So I don't want to change my theory. I want to hold my theory fixed. So if I want to hold my theory fixed, I should freeze the modes that would come out to the boundary and try to affect them significantly. So I should hold them fixed, which is why these modes, which are not normalizable and therefore will have a significant effect on the boundary, I hold frozen. That's why they are the classical sources that I can turn on to deform my theory. What they do is they modify the expectation values of operators because they give me a partition function in the presence of the sources, right? So this gadget was just the logarithm of the generating function with this insertion of J times O. Right? So I've taken the CFT partition function, added this extra piece, and then tried to compute this explicitly. We usually can't do this explicitly for finite sources. We do it for infinitesimal sources and then vary to get the correlation functions. But if you could do this for explicit for finite sources, the gravitational problem says you do it by freezing some set of one half of the modes near the boundary and measure the other half of the modes of the response. So this guy is the response with source. I should put a J here because this is a nonlinear response. Which is why I said last time that this problem is like doing electrodynamics in a box. You freeze one set of modes for the electric fields, and then you ask what's happening inside, and then you find the other set of modes and learn what the response was. Except that now you do it not just for electromagnetism, you do it for every field with every set of quantum numbers you have inside. So to answer the two questions that came earlier, you can do this. I sort of gave you the answer in the simple case of scalar field, but let's say you're interested in finding the CFT state with certain set of expectation values of operators. So I give you a handful of data. I tell you something about the state, which means I can give you some operator expectation values. I think now I'm done with this, so I can erase this. And then you try to solve the gravitational problem with those boundary conditions. So you need to characterize the state somehow. Let's say you characterize the expectation values of various CFT operators. Then you solve with these sources, you solve the gravitational equations. From our gravity Lagrangian, but now I have put in the matter fields, because it may be that I give you expectation values for things like some scalar operators, so I have to put in, I have to solve the gravity coupled to matter equation of motion, okay. Subject to the boundary conditions set by the sources. This assumes that the state I am describing is well described by geometry. We would believe the statement if we solved, if you gave me some set of sources, gave me some characterization of the state, I went ahead, solved the equations of motion, found a geometry. And if that geometry happened to be smooth, regular, and the curvatures were all nice and bounded everywhere, I might have confidence that I have come up with a gravitational dual to the state you want to study. If I have singularities, if I have curvature blow-ups, all bets are off. Okay? So this is a sort of one-way street. We don't know fully which set of CFT states are well described by classical geometries. There, however, exists an algorithm for us to try to construct such geometries. Yeah. So that's an excellent question. So the question was, what other kinds of geometries are known so far other than ADS? So let me give you one very nice example that's very easy to construct. So let's say you want to build the coherent state of a single bosonic operator. Okay. So let's say you have O, it's bosonic, so it's a scalar operator. Let's say it has dimension delta. In global ADS, I told you that everything looks like a harmonic oscillator. So it means that the eigenvalues, the eigenspectrum of the corresponding field in global ADS D plus 1 is basically something like this. So L is some angular quantum number, N is just the harmonic label, and delta is the conformal dimension coming from this. So there's a gap, so because there's a, it's an oscillator. Okay, I've dropped some scale, so this should be in units of LADS, I guess. It's energy. So you can try to populate the lowest mode, just the mode with energy eigenfrequency delta. So it just, you have a harmonic potential, you sort of keep dropping various quanta into their ground state. What you want to do is build up a macroscope, and you can therefore ask that the corresponding boundary state, you can say that the expectation value of O is something, and homogeneous. It's homogeneous on the sphere, and it's some value, it stays put for all time. It's fixed. So there are a lot of symmetries here. Since it's homogeneous, it's time translational invariant. You have spherical symmetry, you have time translational symmetry. So you can solve these equations with these ansatz. I have time translational symmetry, so I can pick a time coordinate that has that feature. I have spherical symmetry, so I can write down metric ansatz that respects the time translation and spherical symmetry. So it's parameterized by two unknown functions. And then there's a scalar field, which is parameterized by one more unknown function. Okay. The boundary value of the scalar, there are no sources, so scalar has to go to zero in this piece, and it has to give me this wave, which I'm giving you. That this is the easiest problem you can solve. It's three second order ODEs. In fact, two of them you can eliminate algebraically. It's one second order ODE that you can solve by shooting. Okay? So that's a simple geometry you can construct. It just looks like a star where a certain mode of the scalar has expectation value. So, but you can do more exotic things if you want, and people have done. And people use them to model various states of matter. When people do ADS QCD or ADS condensed matter and applications, they would do something along these lines. There was another question. Yeah, go ahead. So the question was, can I do this for anything other than ADS? The answer is that the story is simplest if you have asymptotically ADS spacetimes, or in general, spacetimes where the boundary is time-like. Okay? De Sitter, there exists a De Sitter CFT correspondence. There exists few versions of a De Sitter CFT correspondence. Many things at the kinematic level that I described for you work as I said. There are various subtleties with interpretation, and that's a sort of open area that many people have been thinking about over the last decade or so. There was another question back there. Yeah?
Yeah, when you're in Poincaré coordinates, or yeah, possibly even the global coordinates, what do you do about the boundary condition on the horizon, for example, like the space-like
one? Thank you. So in global coordinates, remember I told you I want a smooth solution. In global coordinates, it's very simple. You just demand the solution be regular everywhere. So in particular, if you're trying to solve this equation for the scalar field, you need the scalar to go to some fixed value at the origin. You don't want the scalar to blow up. So again, in my polar coordinate, my spherical harmonic decomposition, I need to kill the 1 over r to the l plus 1 term at the origin. Otherwise, I'll have trouble at the origin. In Poincaré coordinates, you want, there's a slightly nicer way to say it, which I was going to say it later when I do black holes. But you want stuff to, you don't mind if stuff goes out of your space-time, but you don't want stuff coming back in. Okay? So you could just demand that all the modes that go toward the Poincaré horizon fall through the Poincaré horizon and exit your observable universe, but you don't get feedback for some things coming in. That's one set of things you could do. You could impose other boundary conditions if you know something else. But for black holes, typically we impose this sort of out, what I call ingoing boundary conditions, stuff goes into the black hole, as we will see later. Any other questions? Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm doing global coordinates. There's nothing in the bound ball. Yeah. Regularity at the origin was the second boundary condition. Correct. That's enough to fix everything. Yeah. This problem you can solve in real time in the afternoon. Okay. So we can now do more exotic things now that we understand this problem with the scalars. And here's a problem I like. It's actually an interesting problem from the point of view of people who like to think about dynamics of field theories, but in curved spacetimes. There's a whole story that dates back 40, 50 years of thinking about just quantum field theories in rigid curved backgrounds, stuff where Hawking radiation came from, etc. So you can do that very easily in ADS CFT because you can do the following. I mean, we already have an example, but let me sort of say this. So I have a d-dimensional CFT. I can put the CFT on any Lorentzian manifold I choose, as long as that Lorentzian manifold allows for sensible evolution. Okay, so the technical term is globally hyperbolic, but let's say I have some boundary manifold BD. It's a nice space-time, and there's some, let me just write it here, it's globally hyperbolic. So the Cauchy problem on this space-time is well-defined. And this guy has a metric, which I can take to be gamma mu nu. So you pick your favorite Lorentzian manifold, you give me a metric on it. As long as it's globally hyperbolic, I should be able to answer the question I'm going to state. If the CFT is holographic, that is, it admits a dual gravitational description, you can solve the following problem. You can solve Einstein's equations for some bulk manifold, which I'll call MD plus 1, whose boundary is my boundary manifold. I'm saying in very abstract terms something I already told you. And this is some asymptotically ADS D plus 1 geometry, which encodes the nonlinear physics of my conformal field theory on this background. And we saw two examples already of this. So we already saw that when B was Minkowski space, M was the Poincaré ADS geometry for the vacuum of the CFT. Right? Because all expectation values of all operators in the vacuum are zero, and so they are in Poincaré ADS D plus 1. And when the boundary manifold was the Einstein static universe, you can find that M is global ADS. And when I say you solve Einstein's equations and get these geometries, I mean them in the sense I sort of described to you at the beginning of the first lecture, that these are the leading order saddle point configurations that dominate the field theory on these backgrounds in this large C effective limit. Now, for a given boundary geometry, it may so happen that you have multiple saddles. Okay? Saddle point approximation typically for integrals or functional integrals can give you multiple saddles. These saddles can exchange dominance. You can therefore have things like phase transitions where in some domain for some parameters or some properties of this boundary manifold, there is a particular bulk manifold that tells you all the properties of the theory. But for some other domain of the boundary manifold, there is some other geometry. So now we are going to see one example of that, but I'm going to go through this, go to that example in a slightly roundabout way, partly because I want to tie back to what we're really getting to, which is entanglement. But I want to make sure that this logic is clear, that you can think of this prescription of this boundary matrix as a prescription of this classical source, but now for the energy momentum tensor. Yes? Yes, you can always construct an asymptotically what's called a locally ADS manifold, which has all the properties you want. So there's a, I mean, you can really go to town with this. People have. And there's a review we wrote a few years ago with Don Merolf and Toby Wiseman, which has some of these features. So you can study conformal field theories on De Sitter space. You can study conformal field theories on black hole backgrounds. You can do various things that and learn things that you cannot usually do for when you study quantum field theories in curved spacetime, because when you, the usual remit of quantum fields in curved spacetime is perturbative quantum fields in curved spacetime. So, but I mean, they're doing something completely different here. We're taking strongly coupled quantum fields and using the holographic correspondence to get mileage. Any other questions? OK, so I have 10 minutes. OK, so since I have 10 minutes, let me set up the problem and then solve it for you next time. So the problem I want to solve is this. I want to do, so we studied the vacuum. The vacuum is given by geometries, pretty much dictated by symmetries. I want to jump ahead. I don't want to solve for other pure states. I want to be somewhat ambitious. And I want to solve for the Gibbs state of the field theory at finite temperature. Okay. So this is a nice state to study because it has the spectral information about the CFT. Matt is not here, but I am not going to normalize my Gibbs density matrix. Okay? Because the trace of the Gibbs density matrix is the partition function. It's a spectrum generating object. If I expand out its powers of beta, I get the energy eigenstates of the theory with their degeneracies. So this particular object will not be normalized. So this is the object I want to study. And I'm going to invoke a very, I would say well-known, but if it's not well-known, I apologize, correspondence between thermal field theories and ordinary statistical mechanics. So the thermal state is characterized by one nice property. It's static state. Things don't evolve in this state. It's an equilibrium state. So this is what I call the classical correspondence, which says that quantum field, in fact, it's true for quantum field theories, just not just for conformal field theories. A d-dimensional quantum field theory at temperature T which is 1 over beta is equivalent to a d minus one dimensional statistical model with Euclidean time, let's say d dimensional statistical model, keep everything space time dimension, d plus one d dimensional Euclidean statistical model with Euclidean time TE compactified with period beta. It's just the silliest assertion that this looks like evolution in imaginary time with period beta. So let me draw a picture. I have space. I have Lorentzian time, which I'm going to suppress because nothing happens there. I'll come back to it. I'll put it back next time. This is the real time. And I can just replace this configuration by drawing a thermal circle of size beta at every point. It's my proxy for studying finite temperature field theory. Any question I want to ask in finite temperature field theory, as long as it's an equilibrium question, I can study by studying this cylinder now in this way. Now, this is a density matrix. So I can write it in an energy eigenbasis as with matrix elements will just be given by the energy eigenvalues. if I evaluate this density matrix in the energy eigenbasis, it's diagonal, because it's just, and the expectation value, and the coefficients are just given by Hamiltonian expectation values, so that's e to the minus beta. Since the density matrix, I can try to purify this density matrix. And let me purify, and there are many purifications, but let me pick the canonical purification that I like. And the canonical purification will be to take one copy of my theory and take its double. So construct what I call the thermophile double state. Actually, let's put a beta here so that it's clear that it's a thermal density matrix. Purify this rho beta to what I call the thermophile double state in two copies of my field theory. What would I write? I would have to write some state which is pure in the extended space, but such that when I trace out one copy, I get back this thermal density matrix. And modulo various phases, you can convince yourself that there's a nice choice. The nice choice is just the canonical pairing. Let me label these CFTs as left and right. Okay. So clearly, trace over the left gives me rho beta right and vice versa. Okay? In pictures, I have two copies of this guy, and you can think of it many ways, but let me draw it as follows. I have this Euclidean circle, which is the parameterizing Euclidean time. And I have the two copies living on top and bottom, right? Because they're separated in imaginary time by beta over 2 after I sort of purify this. They're correlated, the two copies. They're entangled in this sense, in the sense of the thermophile double construction. And the Hamiltonian that I will use in this thermophile double construction, under which this guy is a zero energy state, is this. So H right tensor identity left minus identity right tensor H left. Is annihilates the thermophile double state. Fine? Yeah?
So you say that this state is the ground state, but the only thing that you've shown is that it's a zero eigenstate, your
thermophile is not positive definite. That's completely right. I didn't say it was a ground state, I just said it annihilates the. Yes. You're quite right. This is not a bounded Hamiltonian, but I just wanted to put this sign to ensure later what something I want to tell you later. But for now, this is a this operator has this property. Let's just say it as that. Okay. So I want to give you next time. So this construction you can do. You can do for any theory. You clearly do it for lattice models, and you can do it for conformal field theories. And the question I want you to think about is, what operation in gravity achieves this construction? And where in that gravitational construction is the von Neumann entropy of rho beta? Because trace of rho beta log rho beta is the entropy of this thermodynamical system at temperature beta. Having very abstract, I'm not even telling you what my model is. At the end of the day, I want to ask the question, what does this construction mean for CFTs with holographic duals? And what does this picture get reinterpreted as in that context? OK? So two questions. How do you realize this thermofield double state? And once you've realized the thermofield double state, how do you think about the entropy in the thermal state from the gravitational side? Think about it. I will answer it for you tomorrow.
OK, thank you for a very nice lecture. And I think we have time for a couple of questions.
Good. So I mumbled words about gauge fixing. So I use what's called the Pfefferman-Graham gauge. So the gauge fixing was done by setting Hz mu to 0. I had to define the bulk. I had to define the z coordinate in spacetime that are not ADS, not Poincaré ADS. And I chose them to have this property. This is exactly the full set of gauge freedom you have. And in these coordinates, the boundary components of HAB, H mu nu components, as with coefficient which have the z to the d piece, are the energy momentum tensor. So it's a gauge fixed statement. It's not a statement which is independent of my gauge fixing. So this is what's called the Pfefferman-Graham gauge, what I call the Pfefferman-Graham gauge. Anyway. So there's more details in the notes, and also how to write down the expression more covariantly without ever referring to the particular gauge choice. Yes? It does. So the full formula is this. OK, this plus minus depends on what your convention for normal is. All I can tell you is that Balasubramanian and Krauss have a normal that gives me nightmares. And there's some factors here which I'm ignoring. OK, it's a mess. But OK, there's some factors here, and this, you evaluate this expression and then take the limit cutoff goes to 0. So this piece, so the ways to describe this. This piece comes from what's usually called the Gibbons-Hawking term in gravity, and that's there to ensure that the Einstein-Hilbert action gives you Einstein's equation of motion. Okay, and the Ricci curvature is not something squared. Okay, so you need some boundary term to ensure that you get the Dirichlet problem is well defined. These pieces come from counter terms to make the energy momentum tensor finite. Okay, so this is a boundary cosmological constant counter term. This is a boundary Ricci scalar counter term. So in fact, that's why you see it's an Einstein tensor, but for the metric gamma. That's what the symbol gamma on the left superscript is supposed to mean.
Okay, so let's thank Mukund again.